on 1116 SEN. The Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Science of Sport, Melbourne's home of sport. It's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Craig Harper, Jacqueline Lauder, Mark Fabreo. Professor Mark Fabreo is not with us. He's not with us for a couple of weeks. He'll be back in a few weeks. He's out and about doing what he does, just professoring about the place. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. He's sitting on a balcony in Sydney, I'm sure, this morning, just looking out at the beach. You know how he brings his photos in each time?
That's what he does.
Shows us what his lovely view is.
Well, that's where he resides now, up in the thriving metropolis of Sydney, yeah. Just running some massive organisation with his massive brain.
How's your week been?
My week has been interesting. I do some, thanks for asking, do some stuff for Max's, full disclosure, you know, the supplement company. And so they do these, we could even have a chat about this because they do a couple of 12-week challenges. Now, again, full disclosure, I've never been a big fan of the kind of body transformation things. And so when I came in and they said, we want you to be involved, I said, all right, well, as long as this is my condition, as long as all of the messages that I give and that we give around this, you know, what's good about it, there's structure, there's organisation, there's accountability, there's coaching. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, folks, it's just a 12-week challenge for people to get in shape. And there's a fair, there's an
heaps
online,
of them around.
There's an online forum for this one. It's great. The information is actually really good. The supplements are good and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not comfortable selling things. So I said, well, as long as I can be me and I can be totally honest in the middle of all of it, and they're happy with that. So they do two a year at the moment. So the last one, we just had 12,000 people, and got down to top 10 boys and top 10 girls.
Wow.
So last night at the MCG, I hosted that little event, which was fun. And some of the transformations, you know, and people just, some of the transformations are amazing. Like, and I'm not easily impressed because I've been looking at bodies for a very, very long time, but it's amazing when somebody has a focus, right, and they have structure and they have support and they've got a clear goal and there's accountability and there's a process and they've thought about their food and they've thought about their training and recovery and supplements and all of the things that they can do to put in place to create a result. What some, not all, there's still a fair drop off, but that's the same with anything. But then the challenge is, and I say this every year when I talk at this event, the challenge is then to build on what you've created, because if all you do is get in shape for 12 weeks, then you get out of shape, in my opinion, waste of time.
Yep.
And statistically, that is what happens with a lot of people. So when people say to me, what do you think of these things? I go, well, as long as it's a beginning of something and not the start and finish of something, then a good idea. But to all the boys and girls who did the Max's and Maxine's challenge and got up last night, the top 10 boys and girls, amazing. Like, seriously, I was glad I was wearing a suit. I was glad I was fully covered.
Well, I don't live in my world and with what I do. I can't do 12-week challenges. And this is one of the things you and I were talking about out in the green room this morning. Obviously, this week we saw Buddy Franklin, you know, people saw footage of him and he's starting to get back on the footy field and that sort of stuff. And it got us talking about one of the biggest issues in sport these days, not just in elite sport, but I think anyone who competes is dealing with depression and mental health issues. And we can't do a 12-week challenge.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people have potentially looked at, you know, he's had a few months off, he's getting himself right, he's starting to get himself functional again.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not recovered. For anyone who's got any mental health issues, like, it's not a matter of saying, okay, well, let's just take you out, do a 12-week challenge in quotation marks, like, and get you back on track and know you're good to go. This is something that he and probably a lot of our listeners are going to be battling with for a long, long time.
Yeah.
It's a management system.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we see so many more examples. Ian Thorpe came out a couple of years ago and said that he'd battled with even Nathan Thompson, who does a lot of work here with SEN. He was quite open when he was playing football, and which is great. We're getting more educated.
And a lot of the boys in footy, not necessarily depression, but a lot of stress and anxiety around that. I remember Glenn Archer was talking about how he hated it.
Yep.
He kind of loved it, hated it. I remember Even back in the day when I was at St Kilda, Plugger was always, which you wouldn't think, he appeared so laconic, but yep. Tony Lockett was always very stressed and anxious, and without being too graphic, at breakfast time would go and vomit. Most he was so stressed and so anxious. And so I think people maybe look at these Adonises and the girls also, of course, running around, these super fit athletes, super strong and super tough. But, I mean, they're still emotional creatures and psychological creatures living in a physical body.
And I think when we're looking at our field within sport and exercise and from the grassroots level all the way through to your elite, what you've got to have a look at, it can sometimes be mistaken for people being lazy or, you know, bit of boom and bust type system. And if you're not understanding, I mean, 1 in 3 people are on an antidepressant these days. And
really?
It's quite high statistics.
Is that
I personally,
kids and adults or just adults?
Adults. Right. Children, I don't know any statistics
so
on,
one in
on
three
that. I'm
adults
sure there's some around.
1 in 3 adults in Australia are on an antidepressant.
Yeah.
That seems diabolically
and I personally don't think 1 in 3 necessarily need to be, but I think doctors are under a lot of pressure to provide something. I think a lot of people think, well, you know, if they've been through a couple of, you know, weeks of difficulty where I have depression, and I don't like the way the term is loosely thrown around because, you know, for those people that really do suffer significant depression, it's very difficult, and it's not something you want to see people just going, oh yeah, I have that. Well, it's so different for everybody.
Well,
there's so many
a
different
scale.
Forms.
There's
correct.
There's a very, very big range. And I think one of the things I've noticed working with athletes at different levels over the years, but more athletes at the pointy end, whether or not they were netballers or Olympic athletes or footballers or track and field people or boxers, is that their physical skills usually far exceed their emotional and psychological skills.
Mm-hmm. Very
so,
much.
So there's this disconnect where you go, well, he or she is an amazing footballer or netballer or basketballer or runner or boxer. They've
just
got
a generally fit person who likes exercise all the time.
Yeah, amazing talent on a physical level, but it's not supported by the same level of competence perhaps emotionally and psychologically. And then you throw them into an environment like an AFL club, and I'm treading carefully here, where there perhaps is not the understanding. It's getting better. But, I mean, really, when you have a look at and you know this better than anyone, but you look at an AFL player, and we'll just use AFL because that's the sport of our great city, the vast majority of the focus on the athlete is from a physiological, practical perspective. What do they eat? How do they run? How high do they jump? How's his hamstring? How's his elbow? How's his back? You know, what's his body fat percentage? It's all about physiology and what his or her physiology can do. But then all the underlying stuff, are we a little bit reactive? Do we wait until it's broken?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. We do, I think. And I think the other thing that I try and look at with people is, rather than getting them straight onto an antidepressant, for the average person, the first thing we prescribe for anyone with depression or any mental health issues is exercise. Mm. So it's not just at the top level where you've got to do more education. Where are most of the average people, where are they doing their exercise? It's either doing it on their own, or we have so many personal trainers and everyone out there.
Yeah.
Go and find a group of personal trainers that have had a lot of education around depression. So they put them into these, you know, these boot camps and all those sort of things, and people who may be struggling with mental health issues think, okay, I'll do that. That'll keep me motivated. That'll help me. But, you know, they're getting yelled at. They're getting, you know, some of the way some of those sessions are run. And yet these people who are training them haven't had any training themselves in understanding mental health. And for someone just to be able to get up each day and function and know how to adjust, you know, their program and say, okay, it's not the greatest day today. Exercise is our first thing. Getting some daylight, half an hour minimum of daylight per day. Don't sit in a room because your brain produces different chemicals. If you stay in a dark room for an extended period of time, what's going to happen is you're stopping, you know, all your dopamine, all your really great chemicals that make you feel good, we stop producing those. Because after a while, if I keep paying you, Craig, every week $500 and you're making $500, you go, well, after a while, you go, well, I don't need to work anymore because Jackie's going to keep paying me $500. So you stop doing it yourself. That's kind of how your brain works, is if you stop using things, similar to your body, you don't use it, you lose it. So after a while, if people have stayed in that dark room and isolated themselves and just not got basic movement, that actually keeps them and contributes to that depressive state a lot more. So there's a lot of really easy tips that people need to probably just be aware of to keep them going.
I think another interesting thing around this is people who come out of sport. So people who their identity and their purpose and their focus and their time and their energy and their brand and everything for a long time has been me, the athlete, me, the footballer, the runner, the boxer, the Olympian, the whatever. And then you wake up one Monday and you go, right, well, you're not that anymore. So you don't do that anymore. You're not that person anymore. You're not going to be signing autographs at training. You're not going to be having selfies taken constantly. You're not going to be in the paper. You're just another bloke.
Well, everyone's identity is so rooted in something. Yeah, isn't it? If someone said to you or to me, you know, as of tomorrow, so enjoy your show today, but as of tomorrow, you will not be doing any of the things you normally do. You won't be doing your motivational speaking, whatever. I won't be a psychologist. I'd have to sit there. That would seriously affect my mood.
And that's their practical reality. And I think you've seen it, and I've seen it a lot, where literally on a Friday, someone's an AFL player, and then on a Monday, they're not an AFL player, and there's been zero preparation. And interestingly, it changes a little bit these days because people think about life beyond sport. But still, even if they're thinking about it practically, I might do this or I might do that. And we're seeing more and more young players study now, I think. But they still come out of it where literally their world is turned upside down on an emotional and psychological level. And we've spoken about this before, not just with athletes, but also with people when they retire. Everyone's going, I can't wait to retire.
What are you going to do with your time?
They retire and half the population falls into depression, gains weight, and shortens their life expectancy considerably because now they have no, some people do, but a lot of people, they finish, they don't have the same focus or purpose. They don't have the same social connection. They don't have, you know, a reason anymore. And I think it's just having that reason that keeps us up and about.
Yeah.
So for people who are recognizing stuff here who go, that's me, let's start with anxiety. Why do we get anxious? Is it all about fear of something?
Yeah, so anxiety is on a very basic level, what you're looking at is that we feel that we don't have the skills, whether that be physically, psychologically, whatever, to cope in whatever situation we're going into, right? So if that's someone going into a social situation and they don't feel they've got enough to talk about, or they're not going to be as interesting as everyone else there, or they're very boring, that might create some anxiety. So what happens is your cortisol levels, we've spoken about cortisol
stress
before,
hormone.
That's your stress hormone. So that starts to go up. The way I explain it to people is I say, okay, dopamine is your chemical that motivates you, makes you feel like, yep, I want to do this.
It's kind of a feel-good thing.
So let's say we've got two elevators. Elevator one is dopamine, elevator two is cortisol. You don't want either of them at level 10. You don't want either of them at level zero.
I wouldn't mind some dopamine at level 10 just for
a
little while.
Well, dopamine is one thing, and dopamine is very, it's the chemical that
it's addictive.
Produce as much of when we have Parkinson's disease. This is why we can't solve Parkinson's. You cannot increase the amount of dopamine in your body. What you can do is the production of it and using what you have, but that's what Parkinson's is, so that's why we find it so hard. But if we're looking at cortisol as lift one and dopamine as elevator two, you don't want both at zero, you don't want them at 10. If your cortisol is up at around level three, that means, okay, I'm switched on, I'm aware, I know what's going on, but I can still cope with my situation.
I'm ready for action, I can deal with stuff, but I'm not overthinking the crap out of everything, and I'm not in a state of stress or drama.
Yeah, because dopamine, which is getting you going and moving and feeling like you cope, that's up around level six or seven.
Yep.
So that's a good balance. But then as we start to get more and more stressed, your dopamine's dropping, your cortisol's going up. So now we're at level seven, level eight. Once you start to get to a certain level, where people just switch off and they go, you know what, the only way I can cope is getting out of this situation, that's when our cortisol levels have gone too high because we have to escape. We can't do it anymore.
Is one of the ways of, you know, we have so many fears. So we're talking about athletes who obviously will, you know, in training kick 50 out of 50 goals from 50 metres or 48 out of 50 goals. But in a game situation, you know, sometimes that might be 10 out of 50. And yes, there are a few other variables and there's a bloke on the mark and there's a lot of noise and so on. But is one of the ways that we overcome anxiety around these things just by doing the thing that scares us? Or
no, like, not necessarily.
Okay, like for example, with public speaking. So let's start there,
the number one fear in the world.
So that's a thing that I coach people in.
Yep.
And the dichotomy is that on the one hand, they're terrified and they're nervous to get up and speak, but you can't develop speaking skills without speaking. Like you can't get good at public speaking by reading a book.
Yeah, but
you have to put yourself up there.
But it depends. Like, so throwing someone into a situation going, you know what, just
hang on,
do it.
I didn't say throw them in. I'm just saying open the door.
Yeah, okay. So
open the door,
that's different.
Put your toe in the pool.
Okay, so basically our brain works off a memory system, right? Now, your memory isn't just things that you've done before. It can be smells. So if your mum or your girlfriend wears a particular type of perfume.
Let's not go with my mum. That's creepy.
Right? But when, no. But it's an easy memory. If your mum or your girlfriend wears a particular type of perfume, when you're out, if you have you smell that scent, it reminds you of your mum or your girlfriend or whoever wears that perfume, right?
Boyfriends.
Yeah. So our brain works off a memory system.
Mm.
It takes about 30 experiences roughly of something to be good and safe for us to trust it and go, yep, that's my norm. It takes one thing for a trauma for us to go, don't trust this anymore. So our brain is generally wired to be negative.
Is that because we're self-protecting and
the number one thing your
brain
does is
we're hardwired to avoid danger.
Yep.
Okay, so all right. So
safety is the number one thing your brain does, like above everything else.
I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. And if you suffer from anxiety, we'd love to chat to you. 94291116. It might be around sport or not around sport, just in general. But when we come back, Jackie is going to tell you how to start to address, not to fix it by Tuesday, but how to start to address your anxiety and to step into a calmer place.
On 1116 SEN, The Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Past 10:00, it is The Science of Sport, Jackie Lauder, myself, Craig Harper, until 11 o'clock. Mark Fabreo is not with us. He'll be back very soon. We're talking about dealing with mental and emotional issues around sport, around performance and around life. Ashley and Glen Roy is on the phone. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks.
So I just wanted to come in with from an anecdotal perspective.
Sure.
And just explain that speaking of one in three adults on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, and the difference that exercise makes is just phenomenal. Having been there myself, like, it's great to hear you guys talking about this topic, because, you know, over the last couple of months following, you know, a series of ridiculous events, my entire immediate family passed away in the space of 18 months.
Wow.
And I was thrown into CBT, group therapy, ACT therapy, and a lot of medication to deal with grief, anxiety, major depression and PTSD.
Mm.
And, you know, within 2 years, I'm weaning off of all of my therapy, and that's largely part of, you know, going back to exercise and getting back out there and doing the things I used to enjoy. So, you know, one-on-one personal training, group training, finding a network within my training facility of other people who are overcoming obstacles through exercise and personal improvement,
and
watching everyone sort of move on from their reliance on antidepressants.
Wow. Ashley, you are an inspiration. And you know what, Jackie and I always talk about being solution focused and, you know, figuring out what works for you. How So well done. How long after you started exercising did you notice a shift?
I reckon it had to be almost as soon as that routine fell back into place, that instead of trying to push myself out of that safe space of, you know, being enclosed in my four walls at home, you know, where you can close the doors and you can close the curtains and you feel safe, as soon as it stopped feeling unnatural, it was like, I'm back and I can do this. And I'm back to, I'm running my, you know, 10 to 12 Ks in an hour again. And, you know, just back on the weights, everything, you know, I'm back to entering, I'm entering the Sunset Series in the start of the 2016 year. Like the difference is phenomenal, and that social element brings it all back out as well.
Do you know what, Ashley, one of the things I was going to ask you, that social element you were talking about, there is quite a bit of research from a neuroscience perspective on brain connection, and when you get that social component, it actually does change a lot of your chemicals, and exactly backs up what you've said. The interesting thing I'd like to ask you is, when you were doing a lot of the counselling and things like that, were they just having you just sit in a room and talk with them?
So I did a series of, like, I did one-on-one CBT, so just the counselling regular check-ins with a psychologist, as well as like a group act therapy, which is, you know, they group together people with similar situations and talk about, you know, just finding that current focus instead of letting those issues come up. And so it was primarily just sitting in a room talking. But with a massive, and I had a lot of support from my team as far as getting back out of sitting in rooms.
Yeah, because one of, sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
Because one of the things I was going to say is, when I have a lot of clients that come in with these sort of situations, we actually don't sit in a room. We walk and talk.
That would be so beneficial.
Yeah, and that's why I asked you the question, is because, you know, while you do need the counselling, that is quite an important part to go, how do I process this? But we combine the two. So you're just gentle walking, and just, again, we're outside, we're moving around. I'm probably very fortunate where I'm based that I've got access to just along the river or around the town or whatever. Yeah. But, yeah, it's an interesting method. I think it's probably not used enough. But, I mean, congratulations. Your story is quite amazing.
And you've even got a fan, Ashley. We've just got off the SMS, amazing caller. She is unreal. So well done. You've got, which is better than we get. You've got your own. Hey, Ashley, congratulations, and keep doing that, and stay in touch with us, because we're a big fan of you, and what you're doing and what you've done is amazing. And keep being strong and keep working hard. Congratulations.
Oh, fabulous. Thanks for bringing the topic up, and you know, favorite rip station in our household. So
well, keep tuned in. Thanks for your call, Ashley.
No worries.
Good on you. I want to say to you, you know, it's really interesting. Obviously, Ashley said CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. But there are, I think one of the takeaways from this is that different things work to different levels for different people. So you're not saying sitting in a room and talking is bad.
No.
And we're not saying that exercise is the panacea, right? But I think what we're saying is that, you know, we need to figure out for us, there's going to be an element of just getting out and doing something, moving your body, being in a different environment, being in the sun, having fun, being distracted, watching a funny film, talking about your stuff, not talking about your stuff sometimes, and then figuring out in the middle of that kind of how you're responding.
And it's not just, you know, there's a whole variety of things, but it's our job, you know, for you, what you do, Craig, with training people, for me as a psychologist, it is our job to create solutions and have a focus of going, what is right for this particular person? You know, I definitely do not operate on a one size fits all, and here's my process and this is what I'm going to do all the time. You just cannot do that, because no one has the same story. I mean, Ashley's story is great. Sadly, an incredible story.
Yeah, great outcome, terrible beginning, but she's doing great things, and good on her.
Yeah, but there's little things like, you know, if, when we were talking before about taking the first steps, and I said, okay, first of all, open up all your curtains, get some fresh air, some daylight in. If you don't feel like, and you're not in a space where you can go and engage with people, put some music on. Music changes your brain, lightly in the background. Sitting down and just doing a puzzle. It's very gentle. You can come back to it. It's a little bit of engagement. colouring in is huge now. I did that certainly when I was, you know, going through some chronic fatigue. I sat there and used to colour in, and I'm still got my colouring books and my pencils and.
Well, it's back now. It's in vogue. There's colouring books for grown-ups.
I know. I should have done this 10 years ago.
It's a big thing now.
One of the paediatricians that refers to me used to always laugh because I always know when I've had your clients because they all come back and they love colouring in. And he rang me when it all started to come back in and he goes, oh, you've missed the boat. You should have created your own colouring books.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, which is probably nearly all of our male listeners, there's a massive movement right now. We'll call it therapeutic colouring in, where
mindfulness and
where grown-ups, I guess mainly, I don't know, I was assuming mainly women, but it seems the stories that I've seen have been mainly women, but I guess
I have
boys
two of
as
my
well.
Rugby players that are big fans of colouring in.
What are their names?
I'm not telling you that.
Could you imagine going into Collingwood tomorrow? All right, so we're not doing any explosive power training. We're not doing
we're
any cleans.
In. Get all your right, pencils out, boys.
Yeah, there's a box of crayons over here. Lads, just come over. We're just going to do a little, and remember, inside the lines. All right, now we spoke just quickly, and we'll finish on this. Then we're gonna after the next break, we're gonna come in with a fresh topic. But anxiety. So for a lot of people, whether or not it's maybe like I have a lot of clients who are anxious.
Yep.
Their anxiety starts Sunday afternoon for Monday work. So they have a good weekend until about 3 or 4 o'clock on a Sunday because they hate their job or they hate the situation that they're at in work. And so the anxiety starts to creep in and by Monday morning, they're a wreck. And so too, we see that around sporting performance.
Yeah.
And we even saw that, we don't know the totality of the story, but Jessica Mowboy, who was going to sing. Now,
yes.
We don't know the totality of that, and there's no judgment here, but apparently a fair bit of anxiety and stress and drama.
Yeah.
So where do we start in terms of trying to, obviously we're not going to fix it in a day, but what are some of the strategies?
Yeah, so I think your dialogue, the way you speak to yourself, things that you're thinking is your key, because again, what I was saying before, the way your brain works, your ignition switch goes off and goes, oh, I don't like this situation, this is fearful. So the dialogue starts to become, if I said to you, you know, don't think about an elephant, it's the first thing you think of, right? Mm. So then they're going, I don't want to go to work, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. Well, the picture in your head, your brain's like a TV, right? So the picture that you create in your head then creates a lot of your emotions. So if you're saying, I don't want to do this, I can't do this, then all your fear-based stuff goes off, your cortisol goes up, then we get into this looping mechanism in
your
brain.
So shift your focus.
Yeah, so what you've got to do, what happens mostly with anxiety is we feel like we're not in control. So one of the first things I get my clients to do is just ask yourself and say, okay, what can I control right now?
Mm.
Keep your head and your bum in the same place, right in this moment, what can I control? Because it's Sunday, it's not Monday, you're not at work yet. Then when you go, so it might be, okay, I'm just going to go and spend some time with my family. I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to go and watch a movie, whatever it is. Keep your moments under your control is your first thing. As soon as you feel anxious, change your space. So if you're in here, Craig, and you're feeling really anxious in here, I'd
move
say to you, you know
else.
What? How about we just step outside? Why don't we just go into the other room or
right.
whatever it is? Because change your vision, change your space, again, get outside, actually does change how you're thinking.
Mm.
Then when you get to work, it's say, okay, have something really small and easy that you can control in your first 20, 30 minutes at work. So I might be, okay, I'm going to go in, I'll go and put my food in the kitchen, I'll just return a couple of emails that people I feel comfortable with, and have that space. You might put a bit of music on, have some fresh flowers on your desk. So it's really little things about just controlling your moments that is the first steps.
And it's because people who are, and I've been around plenty of people who are in the middle of an attack, and so have you.
Yeah.
It's from the outside looking in.
Yeah. Movie Inside Out, that Disney movie, have you seen it?
Yes.
The most amazing movie in terms of...
That's the animated one, yeah.
Oh, it's seriously, I felt like ringing Disney going, let me be part of the next thing, because that was incredible in terms of explaining every emotion's important.
Yeah.
And the difference between, you know, those depressions and that and your mood, someone asked that question before. A mood is a response more to something that's going on at that particular moment, and it's temporary.
Mm.
What we look at with our depression is that it's long-term drops in a lot of your chemicals and all those sort of things. But that Inside Out, massive.
Go see it, folks. When we come back, we're going to head down a different track. We'd like your thoughts on performance enhancement. Everything from the legal stuff to the illegal stuff, but we're really going to focus on more the thinking around performance enhancement, the morality, the decisions. What is performance enhancement? Is it part of sport? Does it need to be? All that and more coming up next.
On 1116 SEN, The Science of Sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada and Mark Fabreo.
Oh, goody gumdrops. 17 minutes to 11 o'clock. The Science of Sport, Craig Harper, Jackie Lauder, Melbourne's home of sport. Lots of great feedback from that little discussion about mental and emotional health in sport, in life, in performance. All the people that sent through those SMSs, too many to read out. But thank you very much. We appreciate that.
I just had a text message from someone that said, I just went and opened my blinds.
Do you know what? This is going to sound simple. Weird, but... and we'll finish on this for this conversation, but I live in suburbia and I live on a main street and I have a reasonably decent sized front yard, but it was the most hideous front yard and it was essentially...
It's not now, it's beautiful, your front yard.
It was essentially a plot of dirt
that
was really just a pathway between my garage and my front door and it was horrible. And I spent way too much money turning it into the Garden of Eden, complete with...
Bali Retreat, your front yard.
Yep. So I now have an outdoor lounge area and all these amazing, beautiful trees and 40-foot high bamboo. And it's amazing that that garden has literally changed my default setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it might sound like fluff, but I know that I'm calmer and I'm in a better place mentally and emotionally because all I can see from all of the windows in my house is trees.
Mm-hmm.
It's my own. I can't see concrete. I can't see cars. All I can see is trees and all I can see is green, and it works.
Yeah, I put a pool in when I renovated because I need to be around water
and
that makes a big difference. But
The sound of water too.
Yeah. Now, I was going to ask you a question. We were talking before the break about performance enhancement.
Yes.
My question for you is when...
In sport, we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, sport, exercise.
Yep. Exercise, yep.
In life. When you think of performance enhancement.
Yes.
What do you think is the biggest performance enhancer that has assisted you? Because you've said, you know, you're the reformed fat kid.
Yes.
Right? So what's the biggest performance enhancer that's had an impact on you?
Well, for me personally, it's been changing the way that I think. That for me, it's been and it's different for everyone, but for me, it's been reprogramming the way that I think, my beliefs, my understanding, my perception, my worldview, and my view of me in the world.
Yep. And that's why I asked you the question.
Yeah. Well,
it's because that technically makes me a performance enhancer, makes you a performance enhancer.
Well, I think so. The conversation we wanted to have was when we, somebody said to me the other day about, you know, all this bloody performance enhancing stuff going on in sport. And I said, like, and they went, oh, you know, the drugs. And I went, well, one, not going on that much in sport, you know, going on, but it's not like it's the rule. I said, there's a few other performance enhancing things which are, like what?
Like and a book?
Yeah, a book.
Something you read.
Well, training, lifting weights, running, stretching, ice baths, hydration.
Trainers, doctors, physios, psychologists, anyone, dieticians.
Science.
Anyone
science.
Everything is a performance enhancer. It's such an interesting topic.
Why does it push so many buttons? Is it because I think the media portrayal of, and we're in the media, so let's try and shift it.
Yep.
I mean, the media portrayal of anything that's performance enhancing is that it's either illegal or it's bad, it's negative. But the reality is the vast majority of resources and tools and processes and strategies utilized by athletes and coaches and teams, the vast majority are one, legal, two, are backed by science, and three, actually add value and improve performance. So anything that's ergogenic, anything that's...
An ergogenic aid...
Yep, which
is anything outside yourself.
But often people talk about ergogenic aids in terms of steroids or other drugs. But anything which is an external stimulant or stimulus, I should say, that's going to help you perform better, adapt better, recover better, learn better, develop more skills, develop better emotional and psychological balance and performance under pressure. All of those things are performance enhancing. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we don't explore enough, whether or not we're weekend warriors or we're elite athletes, is to understand that performance is about 100 things. You know, it's not about, wow, he's super talented, he's going to be a gun. Mm. Well, you know...
if it was that easy.
Talent is 5%. Jeez. Let's see what he or she does with their talent. Let's see what he or she does with their amazing genetic disposition. Mm. Let's see what they do with their intentions, which right now are, I'm going to do this, create that and win that. I mean, it's all well and good. And this is, I mean, this is why we see athletes that... from a perhaps a physiological point of view, you'd go, he's not going to make it or she's not going to make it, because genetically or, you know, biologically, you know, they're short, they're slow, and this is not a sport for that kind of body. But then you get somebody with maybe 4 out of 10 physiological potential, but 15 out of 10 mindset and 16 out of 10 attitude and application.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get Dane Swan. You know, or you get Greg Williams. Or
you get Chrissy Harrower, who is, you know, Australian Opal basketballer. Like, you know, short and whatever it is, and basketball is known for that. Even if you have a look at someone like a Leighton Hewitt, you know, like he doesn't have the big power serve that a lot of them have, but...
Still made number one in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always say to people, I don't think he's ever lost a tennis match. I think he always makes his opponent win it. But these are people who have, you know, clearly got talent and drive... But their drive and the who they are as a person is the thing that is making them so much more successful. The natural talent's probably just a bit of a leg up at the start, isn't it?
Absolutely. But then what they've done, and this is what we're talking about with people like Leighton, they've put all these performance-enhancing things in their life, like great coaching, like great preparation, like great recovery, like unbelievable... You know what's performance-enhancing? An unbelievable work ethic.
Mm-hmm. But we said, but you were talking before about, you know, in the media, and I think that is where the media has a responsibility, any media outlet, written, spoken, on TV, whatever it is that unfortunately we've got the perception that performance enhancing is just drugs because that's what gets the biggest headlines, that's what gets the stories. We don't see, sadly, I don't think we see enough really great stories about all the other performance enhancement stuff around, you know, a particular athlete or even like a business person. They're doing performance enhancement all the time by upskilling and networking and all of those sort of things. So I think the media probably don't give it the same because they think it just doesn't sell papers or
exactly. It's not
whatever.
Exciting. It's not sexy.
And yet it reaches more people.
Imagine somebody comes out and does a, you know, back of the Herald Sun tomorrow, you know, performance enhancing scandal. Collingwood are lifting weights.
Yeah.
They're lifting weights and you know what's happening? They're bloody getting stronger. They're running faster. They're
How
jumping.
How are they doing this?
They're growing muscle. They're growing muscle. Hypertrophy is happening. They're more explosive. They can hit harder. They can be hit and absorb impact because they've got these bloody dumbbells down at the club and they've got barbells. It's a scandal, I tell you. They're lifting, you know, but no one
Imagine
gives
that
a...
headline, hypertrophy happening at AFL club.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Due to performance enhancing equipment being wielded. It's ridiculous. But, you know, that's just what, I mean, is that because we're not that's interested really funny. In anything that's legal and safe and the vast, you know, you think about what's a coach's job? To enhance performance.
Yeah.
What's a conditioning coach's job? The same. What's a physio? What's a doctor? What's a psychologist? A dietitian? Every expert or resource at a club in some capacity, they're there to help the players and the team improve or enhance performance.
And they're also available to the average person who wants to go out and improve their own performance in whatever they do. You can go and see the dietitian, the psychologist, go grab a coach or whatever it is. But I think too, it's not, you know, we don't look at it as we said, it doesn't seem sexy, it doesn't seem interesting. I don't think we necessarily put the value on it as much as we probably should.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody just put something there, about buying a $10,000 bike, people when they're 15 kilos overweight. I've got a theory on the people that buy very expensive bikes. I actually think you should go get yourself a $400 bike. that weighs a ton, because you're going to have to work harder. Mm. It's going to be harder to pedal. There's going to be more resistance. There's going to be more weight.
And also what people probably forget is whatever performance-enhancing aid you're using, be that equipment, if you've got a $10,000 bike and you have not ridden before, you're actually not able to use that tool properly. So you need to match it to your standard and then keep improving. As you improve, your equipment improves, because you need to be able to use it the right way.
Are you saying some people have got $400 bodies and they're riding their $10,000? What you're saying?
Yeah. And so they're putting extreme. That bike is not made harsh for the suspension you're requiring, is what I'm saying.
At 7 minutes to 11, we're going to go to a break. Science Sport back soon.
On 11:16 SEN, the science of sport with Craig Harper, Jackie Lada, and Mark Fabreo.
Oh, goody gumdrops. Welcome back. 4 minutes to 11 o'clock. The Science Sport is the name of the show. We're going to quickly finish with a brief conversation around weight. Weight. So getting on the scales seems to be a source of not particularly tied to sport or athletics, although there are a lot of sports where boys and girls need to make weight or need to be a certain kind of weight, size, shape, appearance, dancing, gymnastics, boxing, wrestling, rowing. Horse riding or being a jockey, which brings its own kind of stresses with it. But you've had a few interesting moments this week with people who seem to have a meltdown near the scales.
I think people don't understand weight properly. They're like, that's my general comment, is I had a client this week who I spoke to who had put on 500 grams. Meltdown.
Did you say go have a poo and come back? Just go back one out and then come back in? What?
No, I have
seriously
a little more decorum than that.
So you're going about it the wrong way.
But hence why I keep my job.
It's overrated. Jobs, overrated.
But I think, you know, people look at weight and they just think fat.
Well, that's a cultural thing, though.
Yeah, it's totally a cultural thing.
But when you talk, historically, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's all about weight loss. Only the last decade or so we've spoken more openly about fat loss, and only really now people are starting to, and even the vast majority now, still don't understand body composition. And also the fact that, and we were saying this to our producer Jackie before we came in.
Yeah.
I said, Jackie, let's say you weigh 60 kilos and you get on the scales right now, you weigh 60 kilos, then I give you this bottle of water, you drink a litre of water, you get back on the scales, 1 minute later you weigh, 61. Real deal, 61 kilos, because a litre weighs a kilo. And she's like, no, yes.
And that's a perfect example of where we said people don't understand weight.
They
see the number on the scale go up and they automatically assume, oh, I'm fatter.
Mm.
No, you're not. This is why I don't like scales. They dictate emotion. Way too much. Someone can be doing 100% the right process. They get on, they see a number. If it's not where they think it should be with their lack of knowledge of what it means, they go, oh, I've been doing all this work and it's not down. It's my weight hasn't dropped down. Oh, I may as well just go and eat that, you know, meringue or that pie or whatever it is. And you go, no.
And the thing is, quite often, they're feeling pretty good about themselves.
Yeah.
They go, and their pants are a bit looser or whatever. Then they get on the scales, which tells them a different story. But keep this in mind, folks, as we wind up, that when you start to exercise, your body, if you go from being pretty inactive to pretty active, you're going to gain muscle. If you're a man or a woman, old or young, to different levels, of course, but you're going to gain muscle, which is heavier than fat. Not a lot heavier, but heavier. So what we see quite often is somebody that after 3 weeks of toil has lost 1 kilo, they're like, forget it.
Yeah.
What they've actually lost is 2.5 kilos of body fat, but they've gained a little bit of muscle, or they're holding a little bit of water, or for some reason it doesn't, you know, what the scales say are not necessarily reflective of what's happening in terms of body fat. Coming up after 11 o'clock. The first serve with Brett Phillips and Paul Aiken, then in the Sunday Sports Central, all Arvo from midday through until 6. Jackie Lauda.
Thanks, Craig. It's been a good show.
I think it has been a good show. So take off the old plates and put on these peas.
And we'll come back next week.
See you then.